the second Sunday in Lent, and we will be on Mark chapter 8, verses 31 through 38. Now, just for the purposes of context, last week, when we didn't have Sunday school because we were out worshiping in action, the gospel was also Mark again, but it was way back near the beginning of Mark, where both the we get kind of the end of the baptism of Christ, and this is my beloved son, and then immediately, as Mark likes to say, Jesus is driven out into the wilderness, and so he is there out in the wilderness. The Mark account is actually super brief, and we don't get that, you know, kind of standoff between Jesus and the devil, and, you know, first do this, no, then do this, no, then do this. You know, we don't get the lengthy part of it, because again, you know, Mark is just... He just wants to shoot right through. But that is what we would have heard to start off Lent. So, this is where we will be starting today. Mark chapter 8, verses 31 through 38. Would somebody be willing to read that, please? Mm-hmm.
And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly. And Peter took him and began to rebuke him. But turning and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not on the side of God, but of men." And he called to him the multitude with his disciples and said to them, "If any man would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his life? For what can a man give in return for his life? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels."
Very good. Thank you. Okay, so we start off, and Jesus is teaching his disciples, which he'll obviously do on an ongoing basis, but he is teaching them something specific. What is Jesus telling them?
She's taken?
Yeah.
So right there in that first verse, he teaches them that Jesus will suffer. Yeah. So he's going to suffer many things. What else is going to happen? Not just suffer, he will...
Be killed.
Be rejected, and that he will be killed, and that what will happen after he dies?
3 days he will rise.
Okay, so he says this very matter-of-factly. He says this very plainly. This is not, you know, layered inside of a parable of some sort, or with winks and nods and nudges, so that they can't catch what he's saying. He says it very plainly, and how would you describe what you think the disciples' response is?
They
could have been bewildered.
They don't like what they're hearing.
Bewildered, they don't like it. They're probably shocked. Jesus has not been doing this, and often when he does teach, like I said, he teaches through stories. And some of these stories require further explanation. So it's not that particularly common for him to speak so directly and so plainly. As a matter of fact, for Mark to actually say he spoke plainly about this is trying to point out just how clear this was. Do the disciples understand what he's talking about?
No.
I don't think so. This is kind of the first time they're hearing these things, and they're sort of taken aback. So, Jesus says these very plain things. Why, if you're one of the disciples, so we're, you know, kind of put ourselves in their shoes for a second, why would Jesus tell you that he's going to suffer?
Prepare you to get you ready.
Okay, all right. How would you take that? Oh, by the way, I am going to
pretty bad.
Suffer and be rejected, and I'm going to die. You've not heard this before, or you've not had it really explained to you, and he is saying it plainly. What are some of the thoughts that run through your head?
Why?
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 That's a great one.
How do you know?
How do you know? Well, says who? So there's some obvious follow-up questions here. And maybe they asked him or maybe they didn't, but that's, you know, that's not really what Mark is concentrating on. But all of these feelings and thoughts and all this confusion and all these questions, at least one person has something to say. Who is that?
Peter.
Peter. All right. What is Peter's response to this? So if everybody else is confused, Peter's actually going to say something.
An alternate.
So what, this is a very interesting line, and we can skip over it if we move too quickly, but I want to think about this for a second. Peter took Jesus aside and began to rebuke him. So what does that make you think of? Like, try to describe that scenario. What is it like for Peter to...
Away a little bit and don't. Why are you doing this?
Yeah. Now, why would Peter pull him away and not just respond right in the middle of everything?
He didn't want people to hear.
Okay. Why not?
Because they might not believe or follow him.
Doubted.
Okay. There could be an issue of doubt or people not following. I think there might even be an issue of trying to avoid embarrassment. Have you ever had to correct someone or to tell somebody to calm down or whatever, but you don't really want to do it in front of the group and make them feel worse than they already will. So you sort of, you take them aside, your zipper's down, or, you're starting to get kind of loud. Maybe you could tone it down. So I think Peter is trying to do this, not just quietly, he's also sort of trying to do it privately. What is Jesus' response for being taken to the side and rebuked privately by Peter?
Get behind me, Satan.
He rebukes Peter right back.
Privately or publicly?
Publicly.
Yeah. He turns and looks at his disciples and rebukes Peter. So let's think through this for a second, because we don't normally spend too much time in this story. I mean, a lot of us are, kind of familiar with the story about, get thee behind me, Satan, and all that. But let's look at what actually happens here for a second and see if there's something to it. So Peter takes Jesus to the side, over in the corner, pss, 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 and he rebukes him. He says, no, don't say these things, don't do these things, whatever it might be. Different gospel accounts give more detail to what Peter says. Mark is just interested in the fact that he pulls Jesus to the side and he says no. So Jesus turns and looks at everybody else. They're not real far away, but he just kind of, maybe take him to the side. He looks at everyone else and then rebukes Peter. Get behind me, Satan. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely the concerns of man. So, why would Jesus do this? It's almost like Peter's not trying to embarrass him, but then Jesus embarrasses Peter.
Because Peter's being tempted. To do the wrong thing.
Peter's being tempted to do the wrong thing. And so, how can you deal with that?
Well, I think it's just not Peter's fault. He was, thinking in a human way, not in a grand way.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, he did it out of ignorance.
Okay.
The devil made him do it.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
That's why we all die, because we're not perfect.
So if Peter goes the extra mile of trying to be private about this, why would Jesus say what he says about Peter so publicly? I mean, very, very deliberately turning and telling the other disciples so that everybody can hear, get behind me, saying you do not have the mind, you don't have the mind of Christ.
Make an example.
Okay, so there's an example being made. What else? Think about these in human terms. So let's think about it in terms of something that we might be able to identify with. So let's say, you know, we're in a group and we're sort of chit-chatting, and somebody pulls us away and they say something that's not true or it's not right. Why might you feel compelled then to reject what they've said in front of the entire group rather than privately in the corner?
You want the whole group to know that what he said, or they all saw him,
right?
Supposedly.
Right.
They all saw that Peter pulling aside, and maybe he wanted them to know there wasn't anything to that, or that what he was saying was
I think that's what's in my mind.
Yeah, if he does this to one of his disciples, then, you know, you can go believe that more. You know, they're going to say, well, you know, here's one of his followers, and he's, you know, telling him he's wrong.
Okay.
And if he does that to one of his disciples, they have to believe that it's more credible.
Right. What will be the downside to Jesus rebuking Peter privately? So Peter taking him aside, Jesus, no, don't do this, don't die. And Jesus, no, that's not right, you don't understand, don't say that. Why not do it privately in the corner? Why make sure that everybody knows this? And I think you were onto that. I mean, that's the way it's striking me, too.
So everybody else is thinking at that point, what are they talking about over there?
Right.
And it leaves some doubt about what he's
saying. I think so. I think so. So in the context of, he's just said this very troubling thing, and then he gets pulled immediately to the side. So what are they talking about?
Yeah.
For sure, they're talking about this very troubling thing. And maybe everyone has got these thoughts in their head, or maybe everyone has got this sort of confusion. So Jesus makes a little bit of an example of Peter. I don't think it's a matter of shame so much as it is, if these are the questions that everybody else has, A, you answer them up front all at the same time, but B, make sure that no one perceives some kind of secret plan on the side.
Mm.
You know, what were they really talking about? And even if Jesus says, you know, no, that's not right, and don't do that, well, when he comes back, what are those other disciples thinking? Well, he just said this really hard thing, and then he and Peter were whispering together in the corner. What's going on? What's going on? And why does Peter get to know something that we don't? So instead, it's very open, it's very public. So he rebukes Peter, and he says, you don't understand. So I mentioned in the sermon that I've got, you know, a lot of sympathy for Peter, just because the way he tends to operate, and I kind of get it. But what else did I mention about the whole get thee behind me, Satan? That it's not, I don't think, as personally attributed to Peter as we tend to think. You know, Peter, you are Satan, get behind me. I don't think it's intended to be quite so pointed at Peter. So what is the deal here?
He's saying that at Satan, to get behind me, not Peter, because he's being tempted by the devil.
Right. And how does this connect to what we would have heard last Sunday?
This is
the same temptation. The temptation that Jesus is given in the wilderness by the devil to basically avoid the cross. You don't have to suffer and you don't have to die. You want the kingdoms of the world? I'll give them to you. I will just sign it over and give you the keys. All you have to do is worship me. And so, so again, this element of the easy way out, of using the, you know, his power to not fulfill the cross, not do the things that will be difficult to do. And so this temptation, what Peter says, is really connected to temptations that Jesus has already had to resist. And, you know, we can think that he's really kind of smacking down Peter. And, I mean, I think Peter's been chastised here. But really, this is a rejection, I think, of the repeated temptation of the devil.
If the devil can discredit Jesus, he discredits God.
Right.
And wins.
Right.
And that's, you can't do that. You know, and Jesus is not going to let him do that.
And so again, it's up front, it's public, it's so everybody can hear. Okay, so we shift to this next section, and interestingly enough, and I mean, maybe this is just the way that Mark likes to write, because everything is so action-oriented, and there's never any downtime, but it seems that Jesus is taught about his coming death and resurrection. Peter doesn't understand. Jesus rebukes that temptation, and then what happens next? Who was Jesus speaking to next?
Multitude.
Big group of people.
Okay, so he's there with his disciples, teaching his disciples, but as soon as this happens, he then gathers a bunch of people, or he starts talking to the whole crowd that's there. So in the beginning, he was just teaching to a smaller group. Now he's teaching to the wider group. And what does he teach them? What's the first thing that he says?
If any man would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me.
Okay. So, in relation to Jesus talking about his suffering and death and the rebuking of Satan, what does it mean for Jesus to say, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny himself and take up their cross and follow me?
Love only him.
Love only him. It's good.
Turn from the sinfulness that is mankind.
Okay. Now, I think, hear this very symbolically. You know, because we know the whole story. Mm-hmm. You know, that we know that he will literally be nailed to a cross, and there's going to come a moment where, you know, he is forced to carry the cross beam for a period of time to get to the place of execution, and that then he will die and he'll be raised again. So I think we tend to hear these words as metaphorical or spiritual. You know, whoever wants to be on the human must deny themselves and take up their cross. And I think, at least for me, I kind of imagine, you know, Jesus carrying the cross beam and everything else. So let's remember, none of this has happened yet. Okay? What do the people listening to Jesus know about crosses?
Suffering.
They're bad. Yeah. Okay? Who uses crosses?
Romans
do. The bad guys, the ones that we all hate and want to get rid of. What does it mean to be crucified?
Suffer.
To suffer terribly. This is a horrible, horrible method of execution that is reserved for what kind of people?
The worst.
These are people who are typically really notorious criminals, or people who are, they've done something that the Romans hate so much that they want to make a terrible example of, so nobody else would ever dare to do it. Okay? So they're not thinking, you know, the cross like I wear around my neck to show that I'm a disciple of Jesus. They don't know any of this stuff yet. When Jesus says, take up your cross, the only thing these people know is an execution. To pick up a cross means be executed like a terrible criminal. That's all they know. So, hear those words again. Then Jesus called the crowd to him along with his disciples, and said, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But for whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. So how do those words strike you after considering what the original listeners must have thought about.
Well, it wasn't the things to come. So.
This is not an easy thing to hear.
No, they're kind of thinking, is he telling me I'm going to have to be crucified myself?
They don't have a spiritual connection to draw here. You know, the only connection they have is real and practical. So, you know, they, and that's not to say that you couldn't even then come up with a spiritual understanding of what it means to be, you know, would you be willing to sacrifice your life and everything else. But, you know, they do not have the benefit of knowing the entire gospel story from beginning to end. They hear Jesus talking about something that they knew, but they knew it as something just terrible, period. There's nothing redeeming about a cross to the people who hear this. When they hear cross, all they think of is executed criminals.
Can't relate that to Jesus.
That's hard.
Yeah.
This is hard. And I want to suggest this is one of those times where periodically Jesus will say stuff and the crowds will reject him. They'll say, no, this is too hard. You know, in John chapter 6, Jesus will talk about being the bread of life and you must eat the flesh of the Son of Man or you will have no life within you. And, you know, John records people saying, oh, this is too hard of a teaching. No one can receive this. And people leave. I wouldn't be too surprised if people listen to this and just said, whoa, I'm out.
Would they even understand it?
Maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe they walk away like Peter, so confused, they're not exactly sure what to do with it. But at the very least, I think it's worth remembering how this must have struck them. Because it strikes us, I think, differently. Which is not wrong, but I think it can be helpful to remember that original audience, because there's something important there.
It might be surprising to them that Jesus would say something like this. You know, I mean, out of context, it's has nothing to do with them.
Well, let's put it in another term. People are starting to follow Jesus because he's preaching and teaching, saying all these powerful things. He's also healing people, and there's thought that he is the Messiah. Now, what did people expect the Messiah at this time to do? Anybody remember?
Take over.
To take over. And that doesn't mean just spiritually. It means how? You are going to kick out Rome. And you are going to reestablish the kingdom of Israel as existed under King David. So the Messiah who sits on the throne of David, I mean, this is going to be like a political thing. This is going to be a military thing. That doesn't mean it can't also be spiritual, but if we're going to find a Messiah, we're going to find the guy who's going to lead the revolt. He's going to lead the revolution. So, Jesus has just said, if you follow me, where is this going to go?
You have to lose your life for my sake.
Oh, so suddenly he's not talking about beating up the Romans and kicking them out and establishing a new golden age of the kingdom of Israel. He's saying, if you follow me, you're going to die. If you follow me, there will be a cross. If you follow me, you will have to deny what you want and what you like and the things of yourself that are not of God. You have to be willing to give up your life. So again, because we know how the story ends, we tend to hear it, I think, more spiritualized. But the people who he is teaching, how do you think they heard it?
Probably pretty
literally and pretty matter of fact. And I think it makes Peter's response maybe all the more understandable. No, we don't want you to die. You know, he doesn't understand. We know, oh, it's going to be okay. You know, it's darkest before the dawn or whatever. But they are really getting shaken here. If they thought victory meant we are going to beat our opponents and we are going to win and be in power, it's only now that Jesus is saying that's not what victory in God really means. So in light of this, what does victory in God really mean?
Bigger picture.
A bigger picture?
Yeah. A life forever.
But can they imagine that?
This is hard for them. I'm positive. Yeah. I'm positive. Yeah. And I think we ought to wrestle with that because it's a real part of this. You know, if this is only a spiritual cross, then we can all say, oh, you know, fine. I will carry the spiritual burden of whatever. But could it be a physical cross?
I think so. Yeah.
To anybody. I mean, it's unlikely that, you know, anyone would be literally crucified, but could following Jesus result in physical, tangible, real suffering and physical, tangible, real death?
Yes. It did.
Yes.
And it did.
Yes.
And
it certainly did then, but even now it still could.
Sure.
So, when I say we spiritualize this, I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm just saying it's not complete. A willingness to deny ourselves isn't just giving up chocolate in Lent. A willingness to deny ourselves needs to be kind of open-ended. For these people, it could have literally meant carrying a wooden cross and dying. And for us, that's extremely unlikely. But the willingness doesn't change regardless of the outcome. A willingness says, I will follow you, Jesus. I will deny myself and I will follow you. Whether that cross is physical, whether it's spiritual, whether it's any of that.
Regardless.
I have nothing that is worth more than my soul. But if I lose it, I can't. So whether it's accumulating physical riches or avoiding pain, all that stuff is worth giving up. Because when I follow you and I am open and willing for no matter what, that's when my soul is regained. Now, may none of us suffer physically and die painfully for the gospel. I don't want that to happen to anybody. But the terms that are being described here, I think, are stark on purpose. That it becomes a matter of priority and willingness.
Wouldn't it be Jesus's point to, after he is crucified, they would understand what he was talking about?
Absolutely. And, you know, the resurrected Christ will say, don't you remember when I? And, of course, they don't. So, it's an ongoing process. You teachers, how many times did you have to teach a concept? Once? Did you explain something once and everybody just got it? Or do you have to repeat yourself multiple times? And then over the long term, not only keep repeating yourself, but build back and make connections to what you've already done. So while this is very clear, it is not complete because he's going to keep at him. And he's going to lay some groundwork, he's going to plant some seeds that they won't even realize sometimes. And, you know, remember, these are the same disciples that when it actually happens, they don't connect the dots. They only connect the dots after the fact. Once he's resurrected and he says, hey, remember those dots? Let's connect them. Oh, now. But when the time actually came, you know.
And it's more believable because he said it before it happened.
Right.
So he's telling the
future.
And
they didn't get it.
He's giving them the future.
But can you imagine that? Can you imagine something... that you have sort of either prepared for or practiced for, but when it actually happens, you sort of don't know what to do with yourself. Like, it seems unreal.
Sure.
And all the stuff that you had done, it kind of just goes right out of your head.
Fire drills.
A fire drill. Okay, you can do a fire drill in school or even in your home, and it's very pro forma. It's very, you know, blah, blah, blah. Okay, everyone, get your stuff, form a line. Now, if your room actually filled with smoke, how many people are going to do that orderly line and go out? I mean, everyone just sort of loses their minds. Now, do you do a fire drill multiple times a year, every single year? Uh-huh. But when the smoke hits the fan, it's totally different. So that's kind of where we are here. This is a fire drill. I think that's an excellent connection. They won't get it, but it doesn't. Just because they're not going to get it doesn't mean it doesn't need to be said. Just because at the moment of a fire drill people panic doesn't mean you don't drill. But that's sort of where we are. This is not that long of a passage, and it's a passage that seems very, very familiar to us, and there's elements that we've heard a million times, but sometimes it's a million and one times where you hear it and something else kind of clicks. So that's what I was hopeful for, is that not just how do we hear these words, but how did they hear those words? Because what they heard is just as true as what we hear, and we kind of need to acknowledge both. All right, we good?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. That's it.